Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Paul Hertz, together with my co-host, Rod Dawadi.
Hello, Paul, and hello to you, the listener. Today is supposed to be another hot day with some clouds in the evening, so stay cool out there.
Today on our show, we'll speak with Dr. Mark Chamberlain, professor of mathematics at Grinnell College and creator of the YouTube channel Tipping Point Math. Dr. Chamberlain has a new book, Single Digits, In Praise of Small Numbers, which explores the connections of the digits 1 through 9 to many different areas of mathematics and everyday life.
We will also be looking back at a recent case at Iowa State that raised important questions about research integrity. A scientist was sentenced to more than 4 years in federal prison. To talk about this case, we have with us in the studio Dr. Wolfgang Kleeman, Associate Vice President of Research at Iowa State.
And finally, we'll hear about this year's Kids Commotion Dance Program, Bug Me, from Valerie Williams, Director of the Commotion Dance Company. But first, we'll be hearing about a book which I was very pleased to discover at the Ames Public Library recently.
What is it about?
It's about mathematics, but it starts with just the digits 1 through 9 and explains simple properties of them and then relates all those things to mathematicians are actually doing today in their research. It's something you don't see very much of out there, and I have an academic background in mathematics, and it's by an Iowa author for that matter, which I'm...
That's very interesting. Looks like we have an academic theme for our show today. With a local dance flavor.
Yes. And to tell us more about this book and talk about these small numbers and their properties is Dr. Mark Chamberlain, Myra Steele Professor of Natural Science and Mathematics at Grinnell College here in Iowa. Hello, Mark.
Hi. Nice to be on the show.
Well, it's good to have you. Could you tell our listeners what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I've been convinced for many years that mathematics is, you know, it leaves a bad taste in most people's mouth, and I think that's partly because of the way it's taught in our curriculum. But I think most people would find many of the ideas in mathematics really interesting. It's just that they get bogged down by all the technical details they start learning in middle school and high school. And I think if we can communicate some of the interesting ideas without all that other baggage, I think people would find math can be very interesting, and that's a lot of what I try to communicate in the book.
Yes, I found the structure of your book very interesting. You just have a chapter for each of the digits 1 through 9.
That's right.
One number I thought I'd focus on first is the number 8, and a really nice example I found, and you have a YouTube video about this as well, is something what you called the pizza theorem.
It's a very nice theorem. You want me to describe it?
Yes.
So, all right. So imagine that two people want to share a pizza. You've got a regular circular pizza in front of you, but it's not cut. And so the two people decide they want to cut it in 8 slices in the traditional way you would imagine. So one straight cut across through the center, and then horizontally cut, and then at the 245-degree angles. But suppose that these two people, they make a serious mistake when they identify the center. So they pick some other point, which is not the center, but then still make the, you know, the 4 different long cuts as they thought they should. Well, in the end, you see you have some huge pieces and you've got some small pieces, but all is not lost. They can still divide the pizza fairly, because if one person just takes every other slice and then the other person takes the 4 slices that are left, the areas of the 2 sets of slices will always be the same, no matter where that center is made.
And for our listeners, if you try to visualize it, it's not really obvious, I think, just seeing those slices being made, that it does work out that way.
It's not even obvious to mathematicians, believe me. So, yeah. In fact, you know, one could use a lot of calculus to prove it, or there are some clever geometrical approaches to try to prove that this always works. And I mentioned the geometry bit a little bit in my YouTube video, but I think people can find the result interesting by itself without worrying about necessarily the proof and how it works. It's not something you would expect at all. And that's part of the enjoyment of math is you can get these surprises come out like this and enjoy the surprise for its own sake.
Indeed. The pizza theorem, as you said, it's something which has, it's easy, I think, to understand that what the result is, but it's not just a little trick. There's actually some serious thought behind understanding how it works. And
absolutely, yeah.
From another one with the number 8, which I found really fascinating, was the idea that if you shuffle a deck of cards 8 times and you do what's called a perfect shuffle, you can get back the exact same deck of cards in the same order.
Yeah, it's not any deck. It's a standard deck of 52 cards. If it was a different size deck, then you'd have to do a different number of shuffles. But if you start with a standard 52-card deck, and we're going to do perfect shuffles, which means that you split the deck precisely in half, and then the cards, when you shuffle them, you do a perfect Faro shuffle, or riffle shuffle it's called, so the cards will alternate with your split deck, one from one pile, one from the other pile, and they alternate back and forth. Do 8 perfect riffle shuffles, and no matter what the original ordering of the cards, you will have the same ordering after 8 shuffles like that. And from my reading, it seems that some people have taken advantage of that fact, and people who have practiced their shuffle sufficiently well, they've been able to use that at the gambling table.
Yes, and apparently if you do 7 shuffles and you don't do it with this perfect shuffle, where you do a rougher shuffle, then actually randomizes the cards quite well. You actually do shuffle them in the way that you're supposed to shuffle it.
That's right. And most people, when they're playing, you know, they will do just a few shuffles. Of course, they won't be perfect. And unless you're really quite practiced, you will not split the deck exactly in half. Your riffle shuffle won't be perfect. And if you do 7 of these rough shuffles, as you described it, then you've pretty much randomized the order of the cards. But if you're willing to put the effort in and perfect that riffle shuffle and then do it 8 times, then you're good.
There's all sorts of examples in mathematics where you have something with one particular kind of structure at some number, let's say 7, in this case, and then you have a completely different sort of structure when you go up to 8. And
sure.
And talking about those sort of phenomena in mathematics is really something I liked about this book, that it brings out more the spirit of mathematical research, and it relates it all to just the numbers 1 through 9 that everyone is familiar with.
That's right. And so in each chapter, it represents one of those different numbers, and I talk about many different subjects, sometimes quite pure mathematical and sometimes stuff we can connect to everyday life, and how these numbers seem to crop up in special ways, not in some kind of numerological way, but I mean in some intrinsic important way that connects to the phenomena that we're studying.
Can you tell our listeners more about your YouTube channel? How did you get started with it, and what sort of reception has it gotten?
So I've had the idea for a long time how to, to try to communicate the excitement of mathematics to the general public. You know, not too many practicing mathematicians who do research, or professors, reach out in this way. And those that do, I suppose the most common vehicle is to write books. And there's not even too many who do that. But, you know, of course, YouTube is, you know, for a decade has reached the masses. And I thought, is there some way to do this? And there was an alumni from Grinnell College who started a very successful physics YouTube channel called Minute Physics. And I met with him a couple years ago, and that really cemented the idea that I could do something like that for mathematics. And so, you know, I had to start honing some skills with being able to produce a video. And my first video came out on Pi Day in last year. Do you know what the date of Pi Day is?
Well, I'm not sure all our listeners do.
Friday is March 14th, yes. Or 314, because pi starts with 3.14, and that's celebrated every year. And so I released my first video on Pi Day last year, and it was, of course, about pi. And so the reception has been growing, and as of now, I have a little over 10,000 subscribers to my channel. And, yeah, a little under a million views of my various videos.
And it's called Tipping Point Math. Where did that title come from?
Well, I made that up. And tipping point meaning this is what I hope will happen for many of the viewers of the channel, in that they will see, they will have a tipping point in their understanding of what math is about, and change their views, become more open, receptive to the beauty of mathematics.
The tipping point in the title also, as someone with a mathematical background, it reminded me of this idea we were talking about a few minutes ago, that you have something which suddenly shifts from, say, random to perfectly ordered, just when you go from, well, 7 to 8, like with the shuffles.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of mathematics, I do find, is a hard concept to convey. But there's another example you have in the book, and you have a video all about it. It's another food one, and it's a neat name for a theorem, and I think it's a very beautiful theorem. It's, well, because it says you always have a solution to a problem which doesn't seem like it would have a solution. And this theorem is called the ham sandwich theorem.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you introduce that theorem using some other foods, too. You start with a pan of brownies.
Mm-hmm.
Could you go through?
So the idea with the ham sandwich theorem is the idea of being able to split sets in certain fair ways. Again, it's the idea of fair division and sorts. And so, yeah, perhaps the easiest example to explain is in the video. Nobody calls it this, but I refer to it as the brownie theorem or something like that. So the idea is, suppose you have a pan of brownies, a rectangular pan, and the brownies with one cut. The idea is, how can I split them evenly? And you would think, well, there's no magic there, except for one problem. Somebody has come along and cut out a rectangular brownie already in the pan. So we've got the big pan of brownies, and then somebody has cut out one brownie, a rectangular brownie already, and they didn't even cut it in a nice way. It's kind of at an angle and just this little rectangle. So here's the puzzle, is how can you, with one vertical cut through these brownies and split it exactly in half for two people? So without the hole, if you cut through the center of the pan, you would be good. And then actually, it wouldn't matter which angle you cut through that center. No matter which angle you cut through, you would still be dividing those brownies in half. So the trick to cutting these brownies that have the hole in them is to make your cut so it goes through the center of the original brownies and the center of the rectangular hole which has been cut out. And that way, you are splitting the original brownies and you're splitting the hole equally as well, which means you're splitting the remaining brownies for those two people.
It goes on from there that you can even divide a sandwich with two slices of bread and some sort of filling, that you can divide that evenly no matter what shape the slices or the meat or the cheese or whatever you have in the sandwich. You can divide
this
it evenly
like
in half.
So the brownie problem you can think of as a two-dimensional problem. And the original ham sandwich theorem, think of this as a three-dimensional problem. So you've got your top piece of bread, your bottom piece of bread, and then your filling in between. And the idea is there is going to be some plane, think of this as a plane that's going to cut the sandwich, some plane which intersect the sandwich, and it's going to be cutting the top piece exactly in half. The volume will be split exactly in half, the bottom piece in half, and the filling in half. And you're right, it's not obvious offhand that such a cut actually exists, but it says no matter what the shape of those three components are, you can always split this exactly in half. And mathematicians, they get more excited because the brownie theorem works, is a 2D problem. the ham sandwich theorem, as I just described it, is a 3D problem, but this idea works in a more abstract way in even higher dimensions and has some interesting applications in geometry.
That's a lot of food examples.
There is.
Your own research involves something called experimental mathematics, and you touch upon that a little bit in your book. What is experimental mathematics?
So most mathematicians, at least until recently, most mathematicians will work, they will have their ideas, they will read the literature, they will have ideas how to extend work or bring in new ideas, and they're working basically with pencil and paper and, computing what they need to by hand, producing new theorems, as we say. And experimental math is the idea of mainly using computers as an ally to help us produce new results. And so the experimental mathematician will use some sophisticated software tools, which have been developed in the last few decades, to be able to find counterexamples to conjectures that have been made, look for patterns. Of course, it will do some of the rote calculations. But, finding the patterns, and there have been algorithms, think of them as recipes, which have been developed to help out patterns. And there are even some instances where the computer can help produce a proof, which mathematicians never expected would be possible. They thought, but whatever a calculator could produce, the domain of proving a theoretical result is a purely human activity. And now we're finding that computers can actually produce some proof in some limited cases, and it's growing as well. And so I use computers to help discover and prove and explore new mathematics.
Well, thank you, Mark. I've been talking with Mark Chamberlain, professor of mathematics at Grinnell College, author of the new book Single Digits in Praise of Small Numbers, and the creator of the YouTube channel Tipping Point Math. And both of those works aim to make mathematics more accessible to everyone.
Even as a non-expert in math, I found there was a lot of interesting information. So
yes, what in particular were you fascinated by, Virad?
Just dividing up the pizza, I found that was very interesting. We wouldn't think about it.
Yeah, and it's exceedingly practical. It's of use to, you might even say, to starving college students. So thank you, Mark, and we'll be back with our next story in a moment. You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Paul Hertz, together with my co-host, Virad Dawadi. Continuing on our academic trail, we'll now switch gears to academic research. I know there's a lot of cutting-edge research that goes on at Iowa State University.
Yes, we are familiar with Iowa State as a premier research institution. However, a researcher at the university was recently in the news for different reasons. Dr. Dong Pyu Han, a research scientist, was convicted of falsifying research which brought in millions of dollars in grants from the National Institutes of Health. After learning about this case, we were interested in knowing more about research fraud, efforts of the university to curb fraud, and if there have been any changes after the recent case. To tell us more about these topics, we have with us in the studio Wolfgang Kleeman, Associate Vice President of Research at Iowa State. Welcome, Mr. Kleeman.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Can you tell us exactly what happened in the Dr. Han case?
Yeah, I can give you an overview.
Yes.
So what happened is that the research team in that Dr. Han worked is interested in animal models for diseases and for finding vaccines to counteract these diseases. Part of the idea here was to find a vaccine that would work in the case of HIV. So a very hot topic, a very interesting research problem. And the team made some good progresses. They switched to Iowa State about 8 years ago. And as it turned out then, unfortunately, at the end of 2013, that some of the experiments that were performed by that team had not been obtained with regular methods. In other words, that samples were mixed where some antibodies showed up in reaction to a vaccine that was given to animals, when indeed it turned out that no such reaction was there. It was simply a mixing of different blood samples. In other words, the typical example of falsifying research results.
And how long did this go on for?
We don't know that, of course. We know that some experiments that other researchers at other universities tried to duplicate, that that was not possible. In other words, these results we know were tainted by the efforts of Dr. Han. How long this has been going on? He may have falsified records for 10 years before he came to Iowa State. I don't know. Nobody knows.
This could probably have to do something with securing grants from NIH, or was this just a case of falsifying to publish, or what was going on when it comes to the motivation?
I have not talked to Dr. Han personally, so I do not know what his motivation is. Of course, we could speculate, but like many researchers, I assume that Dr. Han was interested in obtaining interesting results. He should have done that in a different way.
Yes, his methods were off track in this case.
Yeah, to say the least. They are illegal, to use the correct word.
And how does the Office of Vice President of Research come into this? Can you tell us more about that? What does it do?
Yeah, so in general, what we do is we support the entire research enterprise of the university, everything that has to do with research at the university. That starts with understanding where research trends will go 5 or 10 years down the road. That the next step would be to make sure that our researchers do have the kind of financial support that they need in order to do their research. We help them attract such support. Once they start a research project, what we do is we give them all the support. We give them all compliance areas. We give them the financial support, all of this, so that they can do their research. And our job is to make sure that when they do their research, that it is done, number one, in an appropriate way, in an ethical way, and number two, so that researchers can concentrate on what they're supposed to be doing, research and not administration. So compliance is a natural part of what our office oversees at Iowa State.
And going back to Dr. Han's case, this was a case of research fraud. Can you tell us in general what is considered to be research fraud?
Yeah, so there's a federal definition of what is research integrity and what's violation of research integrity. The federal definition is applicable to this case, to Dr. Hahn's case. It has to do with falsifying research and with plagiarism research in areas like that. In the case of Dr. Hahn, where research results were falsified, this falls directly into the area of the federal definition, of the official federal definition of research misconduct.
Mm-hmm. So that's the reason he was convicted in the federal court?
That's why he was convicted. That's why it was possible to convict him in federal court, yes.
Mm-hmm. How was the fraud discovered?
As I said before, some researchers at other universities tried to duplicate some of Dr. Hahn's results.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that they could not. So in the December of 2013, Iowa State hearing about the situation that such duplication was not possible, started to investigate the laboratory in which Dr. Hahn worked.
Mm-hmm.
And with support of the director of that laboratory, we found out relatively soon that indeed, instead of producing honest research results, through the mixture of unrelated blood samples, fraud had been committed.
Mm-hmm. And give us a perspective of this case. How usual or unusual was this case in the research world?
Research misconduct of this type does happen nationally from time to time. It is not very common.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you have a case every day or something like that. But it does happen. I remember that at least during the time that I've worked in the research office, this is the second case we have had at Iowa State of this type of research misconduct. Many other universities also have these cases. There is a webpage of the ORI, of the Office of Research Integrity, that lists these cases and how things go. So it is not common, but it does happen from time to time.
Mm-hmm. But was this sort of conviction, is this common? Have researchers been convicted before when it comes to research fraud?
This is indeed very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, the situation has been that for financial misconduct, we have this white-collar type crimes that will be investigated and convicted more often. You will see in the area of medicine, for instance, you will see fraud really in the sense of financial misconduct, getting money from Medicaid or Medicare, misbillings. You will see convictions like that in the academic community where a hospital was involved or where somebody at a hospital
mm-hmm.
was involved. But what we're talking here is not committing misconduct for your own benefit. Dr. Hahn did not benefit from this in any which way, at least not that I know.
Mm-hmm.
He had a salary, but he did not get, you know, an increased salary, or he didn't get millions of dollars from this or whatever else. And so to have convictions on this kind of research misconduct where you do not benefit, at least not obviously benefit personally, is quite uncommon. And there's, I think, two or three cases in the literature for this, and they all have been convictions of about a year or less. So in that case, yes, the sentence for Dr. Hahn is somewhat unusual, it seems.
Mm-hmm. But one could make a case that he had something to benefit from this fraud. Just the fact that he could obtain unusual results, he could be published more, he could secure more grants in the future. Maybe he would not have an increased salary right away, but sometime in the future he could get to a higher position. Isn't that possible?
Yeah, that would require a lot of forethought. I do not know Dr. Hahn, and therefore I do not speculate. But there really is...
That's a possibility.
Of course it is a possibility. But again, there is this difference between direct financial benefit from something...
Mm-hmm.
as compared to really doing your job as a researcher in a laboratory and doing it for a longer time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hi, Professor. This is Becca, your friendly engineer. And I am also I'm finishing up my master's degree also at Iowa State and have done research myself. And I'm wondering if there is anything in the academic system that is conducive to this sort of fraud. Do you think there's something that we're kind of taught over and over again, you know, you're not credible unless you have a whole bunch of papers, and that creates this stress. that then promotes this sort of activity, because it's so, we're so stressed out that we find ourselves wanting to do anything and everything to get to this point. Maybe not to the point of fraud, but do you find that maybe students or other people, you may have to calm them down and be like, you need to calm down. So how can we promote a better sense of attitude?
I think that's a very good point, actually. You know, academics, you're absolutely right. Academics has become very, very competitive. And that is true not only for researchers, as we just discussed, like Dr. Hahn, and for highly visible research laboratories. It's even true for students. And getting a PhD these days is already a nerve-wracking experience. Some of my students have told me, if you get a master's, you're close to that. And then, so indeed, there is a competitive situation in academics these days that may lead to shortcuts once in a while. And then may foster this work. And so the key point is what you just mentioned, namely, how do we manage? How do we try to manage a situation like this? And basically, there's two things that we do. Number one is training, and number two is mentoring. And
what does that entail?
Yeah. So what training entails is a program, an organized program at Iowa State University, where we try to work with all students and with all faculty and all scientific personnel, so that they know what the expectations are, what the federal and the state and the local regulations are. So that's a training. We can talk about that a little bit more. We have emphasized that a bit. But for instance, for students, we do have a course, Responsible Conduct of Research. It's called Graduate Studies 565. And we have way over 100 students in that course every semester.
But it's not required.
It's not required. It is required for all students that work in projects where the projects obtain funding from either the National Institutes of Health or the NSF, the National Science Foundation. For other students, no, it is not. And the second part is mentoring. So while training is sort of a general approach of the university to deal with these situations, mentoring is a one-on-one in a lab. So we're encouraging, in each laboratory that we have at Iowa State and in each department, we encourage these mentoring situations where more experienced researchers or more experienced students work with younger people who just enter and who get overwhelmed by this situation, which I well understand, so that they pick up on stress situations and say, take it easy, you know. Do something that will not get you into any trouble here.
When it comes to training and as well as expectations from students and researchers, is there an effort to change any of that given what we have learned from the Hahn case?
I don't think we make specific adjustments for the Hahn case. Mm-hmm. See, what we have here is an experienced researcher who at least for 3 or 4 years at Iowa State has falsified research records. It is, as I said, not the only case, but it still is a very special and very singular case. So our general training, I think, picks up on these things mm-hmm. without actually direct reference to the Hahn case. But, of course, as an example, we teach this course I was just talking mm-hmm. about. We teach that course mostly for case studies. In other words, we look at situations of research misconduct in different areas, and we teach that by discussing these situations and discussing with students and with researchers and with faculty how to overcome these difficulties. The Hahn case would probably be a standard example mm-hmm. in the playbook of that course in the future. But the topics of that course, we did not change them as a result of the Hahn case.
Mm-hmm. Just closing in on this, do you think there was a lesson to be learned from this case?
Yes. There clearly is a lesson to be learned from this case, which is, as I said before, that just offering a training, which we all do, we means all the large universities do, just offering training is not enough. That it is good to go into individual laboratories and establish mentorship situations, more personal situations, yeah, in which we more easily pick up on what is actually happening in a laboratory. However, I have to tell you this, when we did extensive interviews after the deception by Dr. Hahn became public, we asked students in that same laboratory whether they had known anything about it. And I remember one student telling us that, yes, there are so many controls in this office. It is a complete surprise to me how this could have happened, because we do everything once, twice, three times just to make sure that we are right. And so in that case, direct mentoring of the students obviously worked because they were well aware of that situation. Mm-hmm. The direct mentoring of Dr. Hahn, just talked, did not seem to work as well.
Thank you for your perspective, Mr. Kleeman. We really appreciate you coming in. Thank you.
My pleasure.
We'll soon be back on Local Talk.
Listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Now, to keep us in touch with what's going on this summer in the art scene, we have in our studio Valerie Williams, director of Kids Co-Motion, a dance program that takes place every summer here in Ames. Welcome, Valerie.
Thank you. Good morning.
Kids Co-Motion, going on Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th, but the kids involved in it have been doing this for a number of weeks.
Yes. Kids Co-Motion is a three-week modern dance performance workshop that teaches kids more than just dances. We work on technique, composition, and then rehearsing. The kids learn not just how to behave on stage, they learn dances to do, so they work on technique, modern dance technique. I shouldn't say that. I should just say dance technique, because really, turnout is a tool. How many times are you going to hear that on the radio? Turnout is a tool. And we work on all aspects of how to make our bodies do what they need to do so that we can express in movement what our ideas are.
And what do you mean by turnout is a tool?
When you look at ballet dancers, you see that their feet are like always in a parallel line underneath them with their toes turned towards their sides. That's called turnout. So when you use your hip muscles in a way that lets your legs point out to the side or point forward. So we talk a lot about body awareness and how important that is for people in general. And dancers just do that every day because we're not allowed to skip any muscles. We have to use all of our muscles for expressing an idea in movement. So in class, which we do at 10 o'clock in the morning every day, the students do exercises just like any dance class. They do exercises for strength, flexibility, coordination, control, and they also learn movement vocabulary, so they learn different ways of using their muscles. Just the same way that you use sounds in different ways when you talk. And so the word piece is different than the word price. And we can hear that really subtle difference, but we work on feeling those subtle differences when we are in technique class.
And being more aware of what your body is doing, that seems especially applicable this year since the kids are all doing dance about creatures constructed so differently than we are. Insects.
Insects. So every year, Kids Co-Motion works from a theme. And sometimes that theme is a story, sometimes that theme is based on music, sometimes it's different, all different kinds of themes. At any rate, this year's theme is insects. And I thought, well, one, just what you said, we can be thinking about the shape and the movement of the insects. How do they move? What kind of shapes? But in my research, and we also bring in guests to talk to the kids, Dr. Matthew O'Neill came in and Viviana Flores Escobar came in to talk about the structure of insects, the morphology. So now I got to tell you, Kids Co-Motion is for kids ages 8 to 18. even the 8-year-olds know what the word morphology means. That's actually pretty impressive. But we also learned that you can look at insects by what they eat, how they live. There are just different ways of classing insects. So we've been thinking about insects in terms of being social creatures, in terms of being carnivores, parasites, lots of different ways of thinking about insects. One of the dances that I'm actually really enjoying that we are creating together is based on the destruction from insects. So thinking about insects from, I'll say, the host's point of view. So we think about the emerald ash borer not just as the emerald ash borer, but from the tree's point of view. So those are our sad dances, death and destruction dances. But there are also delightful dances based on the flooring, the soaring and flitting and flying of butterflies.
And where are you finding music that gives that sort of variety of perspectives on all these bugs?
Kids Commotion, Commotion Dance Theater in general. Kids Commotion is an outreach project of Commotion Dance Theater. And we have a commitment to working with live music, working with current composers, and working particularly with Iowa, Central Iowa, Ames-based composers anytime that we can. And this year we are working with Sam Packard, who is a young composer who lives in Ames. He is at Ames High School, and the music you've been listening to this morning is by Sam Packard. And he's been working with us in rehearsal when things need to be changed from the music. So sometimes, because we are working together, music, and this is the delightful thing about working with live composers that are right there in the studio with us, he can look at what we're doing and saying, okay, that part needs to be a little lighter. This part in my music I need to really push the percussion on this part. Or sometimes it's as simple as we need this to be another 8 counts longer.
Are the dancers themselves contributing to all of this, to choreography, to planning of what bugs are?
Absolutely.
Yes.
The main point of Kids Commotion and what makes it such a unique program, not just in Ames, not just in Iowa, but in actually the United States and probably the world, is that the students also have composition training, and then they use that composition training to create dances themselves. Under our direction, my direction, Valerie Williams, and also my assistant, Ben Rethmeyer, who's a longtime member of Commotion Dance Theater, we teach the kids how to create dances more than just putting movement together, stringing movement together. We ask them to think deeply about the subject. We ask them to think deeply about the audience's experience. So what facing does your dance need to have? What facing does this movement need to have so that the audience can understand it, can see it, can enjoy it, can have their eyes tickled, can have their eyes moved, have their minds stimulated? So Kids Commotion really is about more than just dancing. It's about creating. It's about collaborating. It's a really unique program. The children are ages 8 to 18, and we have at least a 50% return rate each year. So the new kids coming in don't just step up in their knowledge. Because we work collaboratively, they leap up to the level that the kids are at who have returned.
That's wonderful. So this is Kids Commotion, taking place Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th at the Ames City Auditorium.
At 7:30 p.m.
Yep.
Tickets are available at the door.
That wraps it up for Local Talk today. It's been a delight talking with you, but
thanks for coming down to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thank you. I love talking about Kids Commotion. They are fabulous. It's my 3-week treat in the summer.
We'll be back in a moment. You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I have been your host, Paul Hertz, together with Virad Dawati.
Today, we talked with Mark Chamberlain, professor of mathematics at Grinnell College, about his new book, Single Digits in Praise of Small Numbers. We also talked with Wolfgang Kleeman, associate vice president of research at Iowa State, and Valerie Williams from Kids Commotion.
You can also listen to today's entire Local Talk show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about the people you heard today on the show, along with contact information and links to resources mentioned on our shows.
Local Talk is engineered by Rebecca Reuter. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richard from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard included Pinnacle, Strikes Midnight, and Taking Off by Sam Packard.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Hello. This is Belinda Merritt, and I have the live music for July 17th through the 23rd. On Friday, July 17th, the El Dorados will be at Snooze Hill Winery, 2183 320th Street, Madrid, from 6:30 until 9:30 p.m. The Skunk River Band will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler Street, at 9 o'clock p.m. The Burnin' Sensations will be at the Radcliffe Days Street Dance at 211 Isabella Street, Radcliffe, from 9 o'clock p.m. until 1 o'clock a.m. Clockwork Calling will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. On Saturday, July 18th, Richard Arndt and Joey Dursky will be at Crossroads Tavern, 1790 Giddings Street, Cali. Sunday, July 19th, Get Off My Lawn will be at Snooze Hill Winery, 2183 320th Street, Madrid, from 2 until 5 o'clock p.m. Craig Swalwell will be at Prairie Moon Winery, 3801 West 190th Street, from 3 o'clock until 6 o'clock p.m. James Bean will be at Roosevelt School Summer Sundays, 912 9th Street, from 7 until 8:30 p.m. Another Lost Year will be at DG's Tap, 125 Main Street. On Monday, July 20th, Moonshine Sorrow with the Dueling Dickheads will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main. Tuesday, July 21st, Wood and Wire will be at Blue Stem, which was formerly Zeke's, 3329 Lincoln Way, at 8 until 11 p.m. All ages are welcome, and tickets are available at eventbrite.com. Then on Thursday, July 23rd, Hamilton Loomis will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main. That's all I have for this week. Thank you.